between, you know, the mass politics and the mass party that existed and the revolutionary program in practice. And so it's within that distance between, you know, an ideal party and the reality of it that and this distance was historically concrete. It was very specific. It's within that distance that, you know, politics itself can actually be thought, I think. And in that sense, Trotsky's whole operation and intervention into the early, the French section was about trying to overcome this divide. Because without it, I don't think you can actually overthrow capitalism. And so Trotsky was in Paris during World War I. He was active amongst, you know, Russian exiled socialists, the French syndicalists, and the left-wing socialists who wanted to draw a line of opposition to the war against the socialist parties and the trade union bureaucracy's support for it. And so Trotsky recollected in his memoirs how Jules Guesde, who was, you know, the historic leader of the Socialist Party in France, and actually the person that Marx dictated the 1880 you know, program to the French Workers' Party to, this person, you know, proved, in Trotsky's words, capable only of laying down his untarnished moral authority at the altar of national defense, while the leader of official syndicalism, Jouhaud, denied the state during peacetime, only to kneel before it during war. And so the socialist leaders joined the war cabinet and viciously campaigned against its opponents. And the syndicalist trade union bureaucracy also, you know, put a lid on strikes and entered into what was called the Sacred Union. And so, you know, there was resistance from, you know, early on against this line. And so Alphonse Mörheim, the leader of the CGT metal workers, set up the Committee for the Resumption of International Relations in early 1916. It was a loose network, quite small, but committed to criticizing the Socialist Party and the syndicalist leadership of the CGT. And it was also committed to doing underground work, illegal underground work to propagandize against the war. These people were incredibly courageous, and they faced jail time and all being sent to the front for their activities. And in fact, one of the syndicalists, Pierre Monat, was indeed sent to the front. This was just a, you know, policy to get the revolutionaries killed, basically. So Trotsky was in close contact with the most advanced anti-war activists in France, Alfred Rosmer, Pierre Monat, who came from the revolutionary syndicalist tradition. And they were revolutionary syndicalists, not anarchists. And, you know, the distinction matters, but I'll leave it there for the moment. They held weekly meetings, which Trotsky attended. And though uneven, these people were undoubtedly influenced by Trotsky. You know, Rosmer and Monat, who were editors of the paper La Vie Ouvrière, were revolutionaries committed to working class self-emancipation. They were committed to working class self-activity, class struggle against the bosses. And so, you know, Trotsky met also the revolutionary poet Marcel Martinet, and, you know, who, you know, Trotsky wrote, read his plays while he was on the military train, actually, and, you know, wrote a preface to his book, which you'd think is pretty cool. Priorities. Of Monat, Trotsky said, and keep this in mind, never for a moment did he incline toward reconciliation with militarism or the bourgeois state. And of Rosmer, he said, he stood closer to Marxism fundamentally than to the Guesdists. And in Martinet, Trotsky wrote, the artist lived side by side in him with the revolutionary, and both knew how to act in unison. And again, on the preface that Trotsky wrote to La Nuit, the plays, Trotsky said this, said, Martinet is a communist trained in the school of the syndicalist group La Vie Ouvrière. That is to say, in a good school. And so I think that says everything about Trotsky's relation to the, you know, the best of the syndicalist tradition at the time. And La Vie Ouvrière and other left-wing socialists had never yet really encountered the kind of, you know, revolutionary Marxism that Trotsky stood for in, you know, in his Paris years. And Trotsky represented, and these are the words of Boris Souvarine, a future leader of the early Communist Party. He said he represented a type of socialism that Rosmer and Monat had never seen before. He talked of making a revolution as if he meant it. And so ambiguities and political differences came through in the debates in the Committee for the Resumption of the International Relations set up by Alfons Moerheim. The leading Zimmerwaldians, you know, those who attended and prepared the September 1915 anti-war gathering in Zimmerwald of the French left, many of them were committed to, you know, the existing unity of the trade union movement, the CGT, and the Socialist Party. There were many pacifists, and they were right, well to the right of the Zimmerwald left, led by Lenin. Lenin's revolutionary approach to the imperialist war was foreign to them, and Alfons Moerheim, who went to Zimmerwald as a moderate pacifist, he had already predicted the war in his articles in the lead up to its outbreak in La Vie Ouvrière. And he also, argued for working class resistance to it. He later shifted to the right and became an opponent of the Bolsheviks. And it's important to keep in mind that Lenin really had no real contact with the French anti-war opposition at this time either. And so Trotsky's role in the committee really mattered. He took up the fight against the moderates in it. And, the moderates obviously said, you can't criticize the Socialist Party too much. You couldn't criticize the vacillating leaders of the center too much. You couldn't reject the imperialist patriotic socialists too much, because at the end of the day, once the war ends, and many of them actually thought the war would be over within a few months, a year or a few years at most, they all thought that would be the same old unity that prevailed before the war. And so the internationalist Menshevik, Julius Martov, was also in Paris at the time, initially close to Trotsky, and he encouraged these, fantasies of unity. But Trotsky in the Committee for the Resumption of International Relations, campaigned for a more intransigent line, one that would take the fight up to the imperialist socialists as well as the centrists like Longuet. Marx's grandson, actually, and he played a pretty rotten role, actually, in terms of giving cover to the war socialists in the cabinet and so on. And so Trotsky campaigned for an active approach to the war, an active opposition, and it won him support amongst the left-wing socialists of the SFIO, the syndicalists, and some anarchists. And one of the classics of the time, Fernand Leroy's, who became the founder, in a way, of the French Communist Party, of the left of the Socialist Party, initially. He wrote, Zimmerwald, Socialists and the War, and he was, it was clearly influenced by Trotsky. And so before Trotsky was booted out of Paris, he was able to win the most courageous of the French left toward a more clear-cut revolutionary orientation. But of course, this, was not complete by any standard. And so as the war accumulated, death, the stinking corpses of the battlefields, broken souls, strikes began to mount, soldiers' revolts broke out, and the anti-war opposition within the Socialist Party, led now by Leroy and Souverine, were gaining more support in view of a majority. And this posed a political problem. Do you break the Socialist Party because of the presence of centrists within it like Longuet and the social patriotism of others like Renaudal or Léon Blum? Or do you remain in the party, fight for a majority within it, and try somehow to transform the party from within? This was probably the key debate in the lead up to the Tours Congress for the Revolutionary Left. And to briefly outline the sequence of events, the second Congress of the Comintern, was held in July 1920, where the Bolsheviks argued to settle accounts with reformism in the Socialist Party. And the Tours Congress, taking place in December 1920, so a mere 6 months or so. At this event, the majority vote, was carried to become an official section of the Comintern. And, as I said before, this shapes the French labor movement for decades and decades to come. The Tours Congress is the pivotal moment of class politics in France. And so the pro-war reformists, those who, were involved in the war cabinet, supported the Sacred Union, put a lid on strikes and so on and so forth, and, tenaciously tried to help and build French imperialism, this section of the Socialist Party split away and they were in a minority, yet they were, you know, very conscious about the task ahead of them, which was to tenaciously rebuild their forces against the Communist Party. Yeah, it's important to see that in this early period, the Communist Party is the majority party of the French working class. You know, they take the majority of the membership out of the Socialist Party. You know, the majority vote means that they actually were the dominant force. And that's very different to Italy. That's different to Germany. And so in the advanced capitalist countries, it's probably the first place, I think, where you actually have a Communist Party that dominates politically, at least for a moment, the workers' movement, or is the main force of it. And so Trotsky was initially for a split, but the Committee of the Third International, the official French section of the Comintern, made the case for staying in the party until they won a majority. And I think it was Alfred Rosmer, working in the Comintern at the time, who first convinced Lenin of this point. And so the Committee of the Third International, made up of Boris Souvarine, Lorois, Rosmer, Monnat, and many others, was already affiliated to the Comintern, with its members active in the syndicalist tradition and or in the Socialist Party. And so there was also an important regroupment going on, you know, between the left of the Socialist Party and the revolutionary syndicalists. Many in the Socialist Party, like Lorois and Marthe Bijot, were rank-and-file activists in the teachers' union. The revolutionary syndicalists were absolutely central to the founding and further dynamics of the Communist Party. There was much crossover between the syndicalists and the Socialist Party activists, and some syndicalists were, you know, they were inside the party while others were outside, but then joined after the Tours Congress. And for the revolutionary syndicalists outside of the party, the Tours Congress was pivotal in another sense, in that it had to actually prove that, you know, they were building a new party, a party that was different, a party that was ready to overthrow capitalism and was not going to, you know, cede any ground to the parliamentarist, approach of the that prevailed in the Socialist Party in the preceding decade or so. And so because of that, the Tours Congress was not just an outcome of an internal battle within the Socialist Party, but it was in fact a combined effect of the left socialists and revolutionary syndicalists. And so importantly, however, the founding of the Communist Party at the Tours Congress involved leaders who knew exactly where the wind was blowing, and they were not by any standard sincere revolutionaries. Many of them were Freemasons, oddly for us, I guess, pacifists, careerists of all types, and two names really stand out in the early Communist Party, that of Marcel Cachin, who was the editor of L'Humanité in the Socialist Party, and Ludovic Oscar Frossard, its secretary. And they went into the Communist Party, you know, after Tours, or they remained in the party, maintaining their posts pretty much unchanged. And here's what Alfred Rosmer said of the two. Cachin was a man devoid of character, who had been an ultra-chauvinist at the beginning of the war, running errands for Mussolini on behalf of the French government. Then he had swum with a stream and now professed to be a sympathizer of Bolshevism, although in his articles he had condemned the October Rising and basically loathed the Bolsheviks. Of Frossard, it is enough to say, he started with sympathies for Zimmerwald, then he ended up as a minister under Pétain, the Vichy regime that welcomed the Nazi collaboration and occupation of the country. And so faced with this difficulty, with the hangovers and the residues of the centrists and the rightists in the party, Trotsky and Lenin thought that the best course ahead was for the fusion of revolutionary syndicalists and the left to gather their forces and to drive out, defeat or neutralize the right and the center of the new party. This was a precondition, in a sense, for revolutionary politics and action. They had no illusions in these unreliable people. And Lenin summed it up to Trotsky at the time. And he said, "It would be good to drive out all these weathercocks, to draw into the party the revolutionary syndicalists, the militant workers, people who are really devoted to the cause of the working class." And so the centrists and the entrenched reformists of the new party had to be fought. Yet time was running out. Not only was France at the center of the European counter-revolution, intent on smashing the Bolsheviks, and was in a strong position coming out of the First World War as one of the victors. You know, it was the center of, you know, European counter-revolution was in Paris. And internally, the class struggle began to decline quickly after 1920, especially after the May Day defeat, well, the general strike, which was ruthlessly crushed and led to, you know, the sacking of, you know, over 20,000 rail workers. And the CGT, the main union of the time, lost 3/4 of its union membership in the year that followed the defeat. And so, as Trotsky pointed out, and, you know, after the war, social democracy could, you know, stabilize capitalism. It could, you know, save the system, you know, helped on by the absence of a revolutionary party. And the post-war radicalism would never, ever have led straight to a working class victory in Western Europe without such a party. And so Trotsky argued that it is all too obvious today just what was lacking for victory in 1919 and 1920, a revolutionary party. And not until, and this is Trotsky again, not until the powerful post-war mass ferment had begun already to ebb did the young communist parties begin to take shape, and even then only in rough outline. In a certain sense, the Tours Congress was symptomatic of a missed encounter. Nothing, you know, in the world predestines elements to combine for a revolution to take shape. Historical time has its share of plasticity and chance, and revolutionary politics thinks through how the elements of a conjuncture can come together, combine, and overthrow capitalism. And so the Communist Party, in the aftermath of Tours, had to build with this missed encounter already behind them. With the class struggle on the downturn, this was a problem for revolutionaries in the West, and unfortunately, they indeed failed to solve it in time. And so it would be wrong to say, you know, at this point that all hope was lost. It clearly wasn't, because political intervention could still shape events. And from this vantage point, at the time Trotsky put into the French section of the Comintern was incredibly precious. And so nothing preordained the subsequent failures of the French section to build on and to make good on the already missed encounter in the situation, even if the revolutionary chance was missed. You know, more medium and long-term perspectives for building a revolutionary party in the West were still on the table. I think it's important to keep in mind. And however, given the space and so on, I can only go over 4 parts of Trotsky's actual intervention into the French section in terms of the political questions. So the first is the syndicalists. The second is the, you know, centrism in the party, then the United Front debates, and lastly, the party in the face of the monumental La Havre strike in 1922. And so of the syndicalists, despite the genuine convergence between their tradition and the socialists, Trotsky insisted on the need for political, ideological, and theoretical clarity. After the October Revolution, the progress represented in the Charter of Amiens became an obstacle to further advance. The Charter of Amiens was proposed in 1906. It agreed on the autonomy of the trade unions from political parties. It was essentially the kind of Erfurt program for the syndicalists, you know, combining direct class struggle against the bosses to the expropriation of capital. The syndicalists split. Some traveled to the right, others to Bolshevism. Some, like Monnat, wavered about where to go in between. And so Monnat, for instance, did not join the Communist Party until 1923, which in a sense was sectarian. And so Monnat was, you know, one of the best and most principled militants in the labor movement at the time, but he did not really understand, you know, the importance of the party even after the October Revolution, when I'd argue the question was settled. So Trotsky took responsibility for unity with the syndicalists, but he did not neglect political clarification. And so for Trotsky to remain a syndicalist in an unreconstructed manner after the October Revolution was to fail to incorporate the knowledge and experience, the genuine leap forward class struggle politics took from that event. And so Trotsky spelled out four mistakes the syndicalists made. Firstly, they denied politics, ignoring the role of the state. Now, this is a slight caricature. You could spend a whole talk on it, but I'm not going to dwell on it here. And secondly, the syndicalists failed to draw the full implications of the active minority. So the active minority essentially being the vanguard of the class, the most militant sections of workers who are waging struggle against the bosses, the best of the Amiens charter, so to speak. And if the new Communist Party were to become, you know, a genuine revolutionary party, they would be its backbone. And so third, the anarcho-syndicalists incorrectly separated the party from the trade unions. And so one of the impasses of the Amiens Charter stipulated that politics should have no place in the trade unions. But this really meant, in the context of the post-war upsurge, that it was impossible to coordinate revolutionary or communist politics at the rank and file to defeat the trade union bureaucracy and the, you know, the tenaciously rebuilding reformists of the SFIO and so on. And lastly, the fourth point, the syndicalists prioritized the trade unions over the Soviets when it came to the question of power. And so there was a debate about, you know, the organs of working class rule inevitably posed after the October Revolution. And so the theory and practice of the revolutionary syndicalists, though a major step forward, I think, against the limitations of the Second International, at a certain point they become limits. They, you know, remain, in a sense, subordinate to bourgeois hegemony. Trotsky's entire, you know, polemic against the revolutionary syndicalists on these points provides us with an example of how, you know, a political doctrine or a political tradition goes through, is tested in the course of history, reaches a threshold through its own contradictions, and then needs a resolution. And, you know, the October Revolution was precisely that for them. And so this, you know, happened for the revolutionary syndicalists, and the historical experience of the October Revolution, you know, it produces, new discoveries for the working class. You know, the working class taking power actually, you know, completely redraws the map of revolutionary politics, and it provided an opportunity to incorporate the most militant sections of the syndicalists while also settling accounts with their more retrograde dogmas. But on the question of the centrists, and this is really central in the early period of the French Communist Party from until at least 1922. You know, if Trotsky, through bonds of friendship and politics, was sympathetic to the syndicalists, he was utterly contemptuous to the centrists and the right. You know, centrism in the French Communist Party was a politics of wasting time, attached to the bourgeois republic, and it was unable to, you know, set to work a politics based on the experience of working class struggle. You know, that is the self-activity of the working class. And so after the Tours Congress, you know, class struggle was on the downturn, time was already running out, yet, you know, there was a revolutionary chance present. But in this context, the centrist, leader of the party, for instance, Frossard, and this is what Rosmer says about him, he says, he spent 2 years giving the Bolsheviks a lesson in the art of evasion. The centrists weaseled their way through the 21 conditions. The conditions designed to chase out all forms of opportunism from the ranks of the early parties. And the 21 conditions, though, were not voted on at the Tours Congress, though they were supposed to settle admission to the Comintern. And so they called for a complete break with all those who were not in favour or for workers' rule, all those who were opposed at some level to, you know, what Marx called the dictatorship of the proletariat. And they were designed to exclude people like Longu and Léon Blum from the Comintern. Yet, the Bolsheviks, I think, in a way, were under a certain illusion that, you know, a set of regulations could stem such, you know, opportunistic practice within the party. And Rosmer, again, says, you know, what the Bolsheviks did not and could not have known was the lengths to which these men would go with their skillful maneuvers, for they had receive their training in the practices of parliamentary democracy. They could pull more tricks out of the bag than the suspicious Russians could ever imagine. And so Frostar would agree to a principle in Russia, for instance, you know, or a policy like the United Front, and then in France, upon his return to the capital, turn his back on it. And so, you know, the Comintern and Trotsky and so on had to deal with this fact in, you know, a mass party. And so another feature of the limitations in the early period came through in the debates over the United Front. And so the United Front was, you know, a concrete example of, you know, the limitations of the right and the center within the party. And so they were the key bastions of opposition to the United Front policy in the Communist Party. And, you know, the opposition came most forcefully from the right and the center. You know, rejection of the United Front came at a time as well, keep in mind, when the imperialist socialists, like Leon Blum and Renaud Dahl, had a minority support within the working class. And this was very different to, for instance, a country like Germany, where, you know, the Communist Party was much smaller than the Socialist Party, and they had to actually become the hegemonic force within the class. And also in Germany, it's the left, the Berlin left, the so-called ultra-lefts, who were at the forefront of opposition to the United Front policy. But in France, actually, it was the former revolutionary syndicalists who were for the United Front, because they understood the necessity of actually mobilizing mass working class struggles. And so in a certain sense, the right wing of the Communist Party rejected the United Front policy precisely because if they were to enter into a pact of common struggle with you know, Renaud Dahl and Blum and so on, it might just have shown how similar they were to each other. And so the right wing of the Communist Party outright refused to do this. And so if the United Front policy was about exposing the imperialist, reformist socialists before, you know, the working class, then the right wing and the centrists of the Communist Party refused this policy. And that meant in practice that an important section of the Communist Party refused to show how, you know, the imperialist, reformist socialists were opposed to, you know, revolution in practice, and that the centrists, in a way, who even wavered between the left and the right within the early Communist Party, had no answer to this. And they, you know, essentially tailed the right. And so they lost a lot of time in that sense. And so they sidestepped the fact that the working class must be shown through its own experience the differences between, you know, reformist politics in the labor movement and, you know, revolutionary communism in practice. And so for Trotsky as well, in these debates, you know, front and center was working class experience, working class struggle. That's the key thing, unlike the centrists and the right. And so one of the most important arguments I think that Trotsky made, you know, again, was against the so-called left bloc. And so the left bloc in France, you know, had a long history, and it was essentially a proposal for a unity or a bloc between the bourgeois radicals and the social democrats in view of forming a government. The left bloc, in a way, it continued a principle of republican unity from, you know, the French Revolution onwards. So it dominates, in a way, French politics throughout the 19th century. And it was also a precursor to the Popular Front policy of the 1930s. And like that, it was a capitulation to bourgeois hegemony. And so to seriously continue republican unity in the post-war period meant to graft working class politics onto the bourgeois revolution, and therefore to miss the specificity of working class struggle and the importance of working class unity within that, and the importance of strategy within it. And so the left bloc, being, you know, a bloc between workers and a certain section of the bourgeoisie, you know, was essentially, it was a capitulation to bourgeois hegemony and, a dead end. And so against this, Trotsky argued that, you know, instead of having a left bloc, you have a bloc of all workers. And so, a bloc of all workers against the bourgeoisie as a whole. And so the alternative was to build, you know, a block of every section of the working class across the country against the united power of capital. And in a way, that's the essence, you know, that is an extremely important part of, regearing and reorienting politics in the advanced capitalist countries of the West. And so central to Trotsky's orientation, so was working class unity in opposition to the logic of class collaboration. And so for Trotsky, this logic actually animated the Paris Commune. And this is what he says, in his defense of the United Front against the right and the center. And it goes as follows. The most glorious page in the history of the French proletariat, the Paris Commune, was nothing else but a block of all organizations and shadings within the French working class, united against the bourgeoisie. If, despite the establishment of the United Front, the Commune was quickly crushed, then the explanation for this is above all to be found in the fact that the United Front did not have at its left flank a genuine revolutionary, disciplined and resolute organization capable of quickly gaining leadership in the fire of events. And so, you know, a thoroughgoing, consistent, bold revolutionary independence of the working class was at stake in this debate, you know, able to confront and combat the different forms of reformism in practice. And in reality, Trotsky, on behalf of the Comintern, was waging a polemic against the majority of the French party at this time. And it was a case where the Comintern and its interventions, you know, based on the whole experience of the traditions of Russian Marxism and then the post-war radicalization, was essential, I think, to getting this this form of politics right. And so, centrism in the French Communist Party, as I said, was a politics of wasting time. And, you know, they could be very active in their wasting of time, but, you know, they wasted time from the point of view of working class struggle. You know, what would take workers' struggle forwards? And towards the end of 1922, this became very clear when the party was tested in the face of the Le Havre strike. And so Le Havre is a port city in the north of France, and, you know, metal and shipyard workers came out to fight wage cuts in June 1922, when the management announced a 10% reduction in pay. The Le Havre strike grew in intensity between, you know, July and August of that year. It drew in not only metal workers and shipyard workers, but port workers, sailors, and it grew to, you know, at least 40,000 workers before turning into a general strike across the Le Havre region, called by the local unions. And so after the downturn of struggle, in the aftermath of the defeats, the May Day strikes, the Le Havre events were incredibly significant. It was a breakthrough in the situation and something that the Communist Party really had to jump on. The strike was pivotal, and on August 26, four workers were killed. The police and the military were called in, and 15 more workers were injured. And the CGTU, the PCF-aligned trade union, in response, simply called a general strike on the 29th of August, which fell flat. And so it's the Communist Party, throughout the whole period of the strike from, you know, late June to August, entirely failed the strike. They did nothing for weeks. They did nothing for months. But at the end of it, called for a general strike, which, of course, they did not prepare for and was a fiasco and was not observed throughout the region and beyond. And so in the months leading up to the murder of four workers in August, the Communist Party, you know, it failed to intervene. And it was, it's important to emphasize, it's a strike that lasts 110 days, clearly enough time to actually orient to it. But within the party at the time, you know, you had syndicalist prejudices, that went hand in hand with the centrist passivity towards working class struggle. And so on the one hand, the centrists said, well, the party cannot, you know, undertake anything in this arena. It can't intervene into it. And then the syndicalists turned around and said, well, the party, you know, this is an economic matter. This is a trade union matter. This is a strike, and the party cannot intervene. And so the Communist Party at the time did not build authority amongst strikers. Yet, you know, a local mayor who was a bourgeois radical intervened, and pretty much every other party in French politics at the time tried to influence the course of events. And Trotsky, in the Comintern, tried to account for this failure. And I think it's really instructive. He says, only one party did not intervene as such into this strike. Which party was it? The Communist Party. Then when the police murdered workers, the CGTU and the party issued the slogan for a general strike. And so, you know, to reiterate, the party that remained a totally irrelevant entity throughout the major battle between the Le Havre workers and the bourgeois society as a whole and its state and police apparatus and so on, you know, supported, you know, an unprepared slogan for a general strike. And so newspaper clippings from L'Humanité, the party's paper, were supposed to make up for the lack of intervention throughout the whole preceding period. And so obviously the result was a total farce, a total debacle. And, you know, it was an example also of the way in which, you know, centrist passivity and then empty sloganeering went hand in hand. And so, you know, the opponents of socialist revolution in this conjuncture, like the Blum socialists and the trade union bureaucrats, were saved essentially by the lack of intervention from the Communist Party at this time and their, you know, their call for a general strike. Of course, when the general strike was called, with absolutely no preparation, with 24 hours notice, the reformists had a pretext. It was too risky to strike now. The failure of the French party's orientation caused demoralization within the party, sent a section of workers into passivity, and it strengthened the hands of the reformists and the trade union bureaucrats and their form of syndicalism. And the party really would never regain this time. And so I guess, in a sense, like, I'm interested in this talk in Trotsky's political alternative. You know, of what the French Communist Party should have done in that context, in Trotsky's words. And his proposals, in a sense, were not only entirely realistic, but were more realistic than the proposals put forward for just an abstract slogan for the general strike. And, you know, they show, you know, what, you know, interventionism means in the distance between, you know, the ideal of building a revolutionary party in that context and the paltry reality of what the party was. And so I'll quote Trotsky at length to, you know, get a sense of his political logic, which I think has universal relevance. He says, in France, such slogans like the call for the general strike are formulated much more readily than in any other country. They are experts at it. But what was instead necessary was to explain to every single working man and woman, the agricultural workers, the peasant men and women, what had happened in Le Havre. In Le Havre, they killed four workers after having killed 1.5 million throughout the war. It was necessary to display, where possible, photographs of the dead workers and photographs of their daughters and sons. Correspondents had to be sent everywhere, correspondents who understood such questions and the lives of workers, comrades capable of going to the families of the dead workers, sharing their anguish and explaining the entire appalling story to the working class. It was necessary to mobilize thousands of the best communists and revolutionary syndicalists in Paris and across the country to do this together with the CGTU and in the cities and the countryside in order to carry out intensive propaganda. At the same time, leaflets and appeals had to be printed up with three or 4 million copies in order to report on the events to the working class, explaining that we cannot let this crime pass without protest. And so Trotsky put forward, you know, a revolutionary realpolitik that could set to work the working class in motion through consistent political struggle, you know, through patient explanation, meticulous organization, a trust that the working class might be receptive to this and want to fight. The course of action would also have set the United Front into operation. Building on the outrage could have, you know, put the reformist socialists on the back foot, as well as the trade union bureaucrats. Putting the questions to them, what will you do? What do you propose against the bosses and the state who have just killed four workers? Are you going to fight? The slaughter in Le Havre represented for our opponents an almost fatal blow, Trotsky argued. If questions like this were built on, if these questions had been repeated, and this is Trotsky again, day after day, by the party and the trade union propagandists and agitators at every street corner, in every corner of the country, in every village where the working, where a working man or woman is to be found during the course of 1 or 2 weeks, this would really have been a great experience for the workers' movement. And so Trotsky drew the conclusion, I'm coming to a conclusion as well, to the conclusion that the French party had not achieved yet an absolute independence, autonomy, and freedom in action and organization from bourgeois society. And it needs, and yet a revolutionary party needs this freedom in order to utilize the crisis of bourgeois society in the most freest manner and to the fullest extent. And of course, this was a problem. The party was not free to act. It was not able to intervene into the course of events. It was running on the spot as the world turned around it, where bourgeois crisis passes quickly over to stability. Trotsky's standard of judgment for a genuine revolutionary party was that, and I quote, the entire life of the party must express a series of actions that form a chain, and this chain must lead to the greatest action of all, the conquest of power by the working class. This was the ideal, but the reality of the party with Frossard at its head and the centrists and the reformists within the party apparatus was entirely different. Remaining syndicalist prejudices contributed to the malaise, and the party needed moulding, experience, and time to raise it to a revolutionary level. But in the end, time ran out. And so, unfortunately, I've really only covered the period between 1920 and 1922. I think it was a crucial period for the early French Communist Party. But, Trotsky's intervention was also much more expansive. And so, his attitude to the anti-colonial struggle, winning over the peasantry, the trade union movement, anti-militarism during the French occupation of the Ruhr, contradictory consciousness amongst workers, the struggle against the rise of Bolshevization and Stalinism within the French party. These are all important questions that I've had to leave out. And so if you have questions about them, just ask. But in a sense, like what I really wanted to like understand and present in the talk was to show like Trotsky's political and revolutionary thought in a practical state as applied in a sense to an advanced capitalist country. And so, you can draw out in a way and, further elaborate what it means to actually wage, struggle against, the bourgeois state in an advanced capitalist country. But I'll leave it there.